Are you missing the sounds that matter most? What if you could hear every word, every laugh, and every moment crystal clear without spending thousands on expensive hearing aids? Introducing Audionatum, the world's most affordable FDA-approved hearing aid. With the revolutionary A2 chip, you get premium sound, zero background noise, and a 24-hour rechargeable battery. They even have Bluetooth connectivity to connect to your cell phone or TV. Unlike those traditional bulky $5,000 prescription hearing aids, the Audionatum is 90% smaller, 20 times cheaper, and works instantly. No visits to the audiologist needed. Audionatum has over 500,000 happy customers who have trusted Audionatum to restore their hearing. Our 100% money-back guarantee means zero risk to try. Don't like them? Simply return them and get your money back. They also come with a lifetime warranty. For the next 72 hours, the Audionatum is 53% off. Go to tryhearingaid.com right now to order your pair for only $99. Again, go to tryhearingaid.com to order your pair for only $99. Order now before it's too late, as these hearing aids have sold out over 10 times this year. With Audionatum, you can hear life again.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Seeking Witchcraft. I'm your host, Ashley, and today I have on Irene Glass to discuss how to facilitate group ritual with members of different paths. Welcome, Irene, to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Ashley, and hello everyone. If you haven't met me before, I am a community organizer that is primarily located in Western Maryland. I've been leading groups and leading group rituals as a result for 30-ish years now. So this is a subject that I'm really excited about and passionate about. And it's also one that I just ended up having a lot of experience with. I feel like there's a funny thing where witches end up specializing sometimes in an area that they really didn't plan on necessarily. And as it turns out, I'm a community witch. It's what I really love. So group ritual, well, that's a big part of it.
And I must say, I have had the honor of being in a number of the group rituals that you have facilitated, and they are quite fantastic, if I don't say so myself.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you enjoy them.
Of course. So I'm really excited to talk about this. And when we were discussing this episode in general, I was thinking about how I think this is going to be useful for not only those who are interested in public pagan rituals, but also learning how to work with others in the broader community. For example, I know of at least one listener who she listened to the show and she really enjoyed it and she got more involved with her path. And then she reached out and found some local witches who were complete strangers at one point, and they all came together and they started their own little eclectic coven. But each of the members had completely different beliefs and paths and interests. And so she would talk about how they were a cohesive coven, even though they one person was an atheist, one person was Wiccan, one person followed Norse deities, one person was more this and one person was more that. So it was really cool to hear about that and just learning how to work with others in a broader context. So I think that this episode is actually going to be quite generalizable in that sense as well. But yes, Irene is a fantastic facilitator, so I'm really stoked for this.
Oh, thank you. Well, and as you were describing your listeners' group, I was just thinking about like the fact that geographically, that's true for a lot of us. There are more pagans now. Like my little 15-year-old self back in the 90s would have been absolutely blown away by the world of witchcraft and paganism now. But the truth also is that in many regions, if you want to work with the group, you're not all going to believe the same thing. You know, there are definitely a handful of covens where everybody shares more of the same practice. But it's really common to be in a room with somebody who follows, you know, heathen gods and somebody who follows a Celtic pantheon and somebody who is an Aetho-pagan. Like all of that is, as you were saying that, I'm like, yep, that sounds about right. That is my experience of working with community as well.
Oh, definitely. And not even that, like looking at it on the more mundane level too, people work in different ways. Some people are more of a visual person. Some people really like meditation. Some people don't really care for meditation. Like there are so many different elements that go into ritual that, yeah, tailoring that for a large group, I'm sure can be a big challenge.
No, it is a little bit tricky. The cool thing is that there are some good general guidelines that I sort of stumbled into over the years in terms of how you approach group ritual design. And I think one of the most important things to remember is that a ritual is an opportunity for a transcendental experience. Like what we're trying to have happen there is for everyone who participates to have a big thing occur. Right? We want them to come into contact with that which is greater than themselves, whatever form that takes for them, right? So maybe it's their gods or their ancestors or their higher self or the land spirits, whatever their path is. And so we want to be trying to build a container in which that transcendental moment can happen. And I think it's really easy, particularly in early witchcraft, when we're doing rituals out of books, to lose sight of that amidst the, I must read the invocation exactly like this, and the altar has to be set up exactly like that, and what direction am I facing? And we forget the fact that a ritual is a container for a specific type of spiritual interaction to occur, and that interaction at the center is the most important part. So I think that's thing one to bear in mind that's really useful. And then I think the other one that I figured out, stumbled into, is something that I call the ritual triad. And it's a set of three approaches that help you design effective rituals. And the first leg of the triad is emotion. Humans are emotional creatures. And one of the cool things is that we can all share an emotional truth even if we have different spiritual paths. And my favorite example of this is Samhain, because that's a big, easy one, right? So if we're looking at the core emotional meaning of Samhain, it's grief. And grief is one of those experiences that we all as humans encounter. So if you know at the center of the ritual, like, okay, so if we're, you know, opening this with emotion, then what we're connecting to is grief. And we can spin that out to almost any other high holiday or occasion, right? There's always some sort of emotional truth we're getting to. Our emotions color and frequently govern our thoughts and experiences. Our personal energy is tied to emotion. This happens involuntarily, but of course in rituals, it happens deliberately. So finding a way to engage our emotions and the emotions of the other participants, that's huge, you know? It's easier to raise energy if we feel personally connected to and invested in the emotions at the center of any working.
I think that's such a great way to look at this, like looking at the root of, for example, what the Sabbath is about, like the example you give with Samhain being about grief. I feel like, gosh, that's such an obvious thing that I would have never thought of when approaching for like a group ritual, because I think I can be one of those people that I'm very structured. And so I would be like, oh my gosh, Samhain, but like, how does everybody view Samhain? And I don't think I would have put two and two together of grief. We could do a ritual surrounding grief. And that, oh my gosh. See, this is why I love talking to other people in the community, because it's like sometimes they could just, people can have you or let you see things in different ways and in different lenses. And so that right there, thank you for that. that was great.
Absolutely, my pleasure. No, I think I've stumbled into that one because I realized over time that the rituals that were the most impactful for me were the ones where I really had a big depth of feeling, you know? So one of my close friends who gives me a ration of shit sometimes out of love will sometimes call me Our Lady of Tears and Authenticity when she is picking on me. And some of that is like, it's legit. Like, I totally get it. Like, I have earned that. But some of it really is at this point in time that if a ritual doesn't cause at least a few people to get teary eyed, I'm not happy with it. Tears are a mark of truth, right? It means something is landing and hitting something real. And we should always be aiming for that with our rituals. You know, these are more than just structures. They are meant to contain this incredibly potent spiritual exchange. And when we have that big experience, a lot of times that does register for people with tears. So that's one of those things that we're like, okay, 10 people cried. That was a good ritual. Like, it sounds a little like bitchy, but it's the truth in terms of wanting it to be effective. You know, I'm not interested in going through the motions in terms of my paganism and my witchcraft. I want to do real magic, which means we need to be accessing our heart space. We need to be touching the pieces of our ancestral line that need to be healed. These are big emotional pieces. You know, we are the first generation that's able to do shadow work, not just for ourselves, but for our entire ancestral line. There's so much here to work with, you know?
Yeah, I think that that's great that you touch on emotion in this aspect, because I think that sometimes people, when they're especially new in a witchcraft or pagan or magic environment, sometimes people get really caught up on feeling the physical energy within the space of, oh my gosh, do I feel anything? Like, yes or no? And I know some people can get kind of caught up in their heads about that, but I think tailoring it back and looking at yourself and your emotions and do you feel moved in this ritual? Is it really touching on that piece in your heart? I think that is so incredibly important. And I agree with you. I think that's what really makes a moving ritual. I can think of a few examples myself of some rituals I've been in where I've definitely cried during the ritual. And those have been some of the most impactful experiences that I've had.
Well, and I think that's a really good thing to bring up as well, is the impactful piece. We want our rituals to accomplish something and to give us, I always view rituals as a step on a larger journey, right? We want them to move us forward somehow. So we want them to awaken something or heal something or, you know, enlighten something or lift something up. We want there to be a piece that we carry away with us that has meaning, that serves our greater path. So yeah, emotion is definitely the first area of the triad. And then for me, the next one is visualization, simply because our imaginations are one of the most powerful tools we have. And rituals tend to need a visualized framework to help hold the emotion and the ritual actions in them. Visualization and our imaginations, in my own experience, are also kind of where we start to blur the line between I am imagining something and then something transcendental is happening, right? Like you'll do that thing where you're on a, yeah, right? Like you're on a guided journey and you're like, okay, I'm listening to the guidance and yada, yada, yada. We're in the forest. Why is the Morrigan here? Like, that's not in the script. Hello. Like, and that's, I think that's such a normal experience for witches, but it's easy to, I think, forget when we're looking at some of the structure of a ritual that, like, hey, we need to be talking about what people are visualizing. What are they imagining, you know? And we want to use this. It's easy to envision yourself in the underworld or standing just this side of the veil between life and death when you're in front of a giant altar that's like covered in, you know, black candles and photographs and sacred objects at Samhain, and bringing these pieces together, sort of the practical, physical aspects of the ritual, and then that visualization. This is gorgeous. You know, this is really where things get juicy. And we can also do visualizations that require very little set dressing. So maybe you're not building a giant altar for whatever. You can visualize a beam of light connecting you to the earth or the stars or the sun. You can visualize yourself, you know, visiting the temple or the hall of one of the deities that you serve, or visualize mist rising from the earth. There are so many wonderful things we can do to bring our imaginations into ritual space. And, you know, once we get imagination and emotion hooked together, you really have people who are fully present, fully invested in this experience. And then, of course, that last little bit is your ritual action. It's what we do to take those emotions, couple them with a visualization, and get the energy of that experience into its intended, you know, recipient. So whether that's communicating with a deity, like a journey work or a possessory piece, you know, traveling to the temple of a deity to receive a message, or whether it's like offering worship or praise, which a lot of us do, right? We do beautiful offerings, custom blends of incense, pouring out wine, sacred poetry, songs and chants, you know, giving a gift to something that we are serving, right? But all of that is just the physical sort of support for the fact that we have brought in our imagination and our emotions. And that set of three, I think, is really where the potency of group ritual can be found.
I think it's awesome that you tied it down to this triad together. And I love the vivid imagery piece and the touch on imagination. It made me think back when I started in my outer court. One of the things that our high priestess did was have us do a visualization exercise. And I'm a very type A person, and I am not very creative when it comes to things like this. And so I struggled with this, but I got to tell you, her example she gave me, which I'll share in a moment, stuck with me all these years later. And her example, just to kind of get our brains going and getting used to these visualizations and thinking of things, was to picture a fruit that does not exist. Picture it directly in front of you, as vivid as you possibly can. Turn it around. Look at all the colors. How does it shine in the light? And now make it a color that also doesn't exist. And let me tell you, for the human brain, that's very hard to do. I don't think I got the color that doesn't exist, because I was not able to do that. But it got me thinking about it. And that was kind of the whole point is using, you know, your noggin to really get those juices flowing. Even things like, you know, a tree meditation or where you sit on the ground and you visualize, you know, your roots going down to the earth. Like things like that are so valuable to learn and to practice with in the craft, I find, especially during things like path workings. It's so invaluable.
Absolutely. Well, and I will also say that these are skills that develop over time. The fruit yes. visualization that you discussed is one that I learned from the Inner Temple of Witchcraft, where a lot of how you build the muscles of visualization is basically by making oranges and apples for a while until they start to get clear. But it makes sense, right? A lot of us have had our imaginations crushed either by our families or the culture that we're a part of. So we're regrowing that. Like, I don't know if this was your childhood, but mine certainly involved a lot of fighting imaginary dragons, and I had wings, and like I had this really rich imaginative world. And then as I became an adult, I had to let a lot of those pieces go. So becoming more proficient in witchcraft meant kind of going back to that childlike ability to completely invent an imaginative world around me, you know? So I think there's that thread right there too, where we have to kind of rebuild these structures and these abilities.
Yeah, I'm coming from the part where I had to build that from the ground up, because as a kid, I had an imaginary friend as a kid, but I remember I was so uncreative. I named her Kelly after Barbie's little sister. Aww. And I remember being really upset that I couldn't actually see my imaginary friend, because I guess I just assumed as a child everybody can see all the imaginary things that they were making up. And so I just kind of like stopped engaging in that part of my brain because I thought I wasn't able to do it. So then getting into witchcraft as an adult, ooh, that was a doozy, having to start from the ground up. So I think between you and I, we have both ends of the spectrum here.
Definitely. And also one thing to be aware of is that some of us have different senses that are stronger for visualization than others. In Matt Oren's Psychic Witch, he has a wonderful exercise that's a simple visualization that basically takes you on a journey, but it accesses all of the senses. And at the end of it, you go through and evaluate which one was stronger. So even if you don't have a strong mind's eye, right, the ability to imagine something visually, you might have a really strong inner ear or a really strong inner sense of smell or touch. I know when I first started journey work, which is sort of like guided imagination given, you know, jet engines, I would know where things were around me and their rough shapes, but I didn't have strong visuals. And now, of course, it's fucking 20 years later. So I have really strong visuals, but it took a while to get all of that on board. And for me, that sensory piece is still the most effective. So if I'm in a journey and I'm not getting a whole lot of visuals, I concentrate on just awareness of what's around me in that space. And I know that even if I can't like see a vase, I can tell you there's a vase on that shelf. I just know it. So I think the other thing to remember when we're designing for a group is how everybody's brain works. Everyone's going to be a little bit different. And I think it's the piece where we bring in aspects of ritual theater and aesthetic that kind of support the fact that some of us are going to be visual. We're going to have visual imagination. Some of us are going to have ones that are more oriented towards sound or scent or texture or taste. One of the things that my own students will probably get tired of hearing me say, but I'm never going to stop, is that the power of aesthetics cannot be overstated. When we walk into a ritual space that sounds beautiful and smells good and is lit dimly, or, you know, dimly enough to see, but not so that it's overpowering, with a beautiful altar, we begin to shift naturally into that space. Like we begin to move into ritual state of mind. And then this allows there to be like sort of gaps in that ritual triad, but we're addressing it on all of these different levels with some of the aspects of sacred theater, with bringing in light. You know, one of the things that we deal with at my home organization, which is the Covenant of Unitarian Universalist Pagans in Frederick, is we have a large space where the overhead lights are very glaring, and nothing will pull the magic out of a room like fluorescent light. Like it is
Oh my God, so
absolutely
true.
Vicious. No, it's terrible, right? So we have literally a bin of twinkle lights that we use to light that room with. And we have tons and tons of candles. There's a running joke when we're talking about the design of a new ritual. Like, what do you think this is, a 50 candler, 150 candler? Like,
oh my gosh.
It's literally something we talk about. But it makes a huge difference, right? Light is incredible. And thinking about scent and sound are also really important. A lot of times if you walk into a group ritual that I have had a hand in designing, you'll notice that you walk into a space where there's already music, you know, or there's some sort of a containing chant. And that allows people to begin to shift, to really, really be in sacred space. And then this supports everything else we're doing, right? We want to begin introducing these threads early.
One of the things I've really appreciated about, and for same with, I know my students that I've brought along with me to some of these rituals, is that I have really enjoyed the ones where you walk in and there is a guided meditation that usually you are doing. It's always fantastic. And then I have seen where you can go from the guided meditation to a little drum area or vice versa, and you can listen and get in the rhythm and the trance of the drum beats. And then you go into the room. I think there's one particular ritual I'm having in mind during this for New Year's, of course, up to when I'm saying this.
Oh, yes, that's a good one.
Yes, that is a fantastic one. And I really appreciate how you appeal to all the different ways that somebody might be able to get into that space, whether it's through the drum beats, whether it's through guided meditation, whether it's through both of them. And so I think that that's really cool to incorporate that for a group ritual to really just be applicable to everybody who is there for what works for them.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the fun things about my community is a lot of us are neurodiverse, which means we consider sensory input, I think, maybe more than other groups do or other groups have practiced doing. But it really is an absolute benefit at this point in time. And we love the fact that people are able to connect in lots of different ways. So, yeah. And I love the New Year's Day ritual as well. Like, out of all of the liturgies I've written over the years, that's one of the ones that I'm the most proud of. You know, that's such a beautiful ritual.
That is such an amazing ritual. So, Irene, I have so many questions for you. And I guess just to start kind of easy, and we kind of touched upon this with emotion, but are there any specific rituals or elements that you find work particularly well across different paths?
Yes. So this comes back a little bit to that emotion piece we were talking about, right? So I serve a multi-path community in that my larger community is like big tent paganism. And within it, we have a Hellenic group and we have a heathen group and we have a Celtic group. And then they specifically have like a Welsh wing to the group. Like, there's a lot going on within my broader community. So we choose these central themes like hope or light in the darkness. We come back to natural cycles a lot. So, you know, our Imbolc ritual is largely about finding the energy and the drive again after a long winter, right? It's this idea of waking us up. And on the other side of the year, of course, you know, as we're coming in toward autumn, the rituals are about the inward spiral and connecting with the trees as they're going to sleep, and this idea of the ending of the year, right? These are all things that we share. And I think that that can really, really help with a diverse group. So I would say that that's one thing. And then I think the other sort of like best practices thing I've noticed over the years is, if you know how large your group is, there is a rough equation for how many ritual actions can occur versus how many people are part of it, right? And it's inverse. So the larger the group, the fewer the things that can happen. Like, if it's just you and a working partner, you can have a 3-hour ritual with 14 stations and a feast, and that works. Like, and with a group of 10 practitioners, like sort of standard coven size, you can do a lot. But if you're doing a ritual for 30, it's got to start getting fairly simple. The themes need to become larger. And we need to think about translation in terms of, you know, who is there? Do you have children in the ritual? Do you have somebody who's in their 70s and hard of hearing in the ritual? That's a thing that we have a lot in my own community, in that we run the gamut from families with small children all the way to senior citizens who do use hearing aids or who are hearing impaired. And so I think, you know, some of the thinking around ritual actions need to be scaled. And I'd say that that's another best practices piece.
I love that you brought that up, because gosh, I'm thinking of one of my students who I love dearly, but they held a eclectic ritual for a party that they were throwing. And I love them dearly when I say this, but I don't think that they at that time had a lot of experience of writing ritual, and they provided an 11-page script for us all to be part of. And it was like size 8 font. And it was not double spaced, for the record. There was not really spacing on there. And again, I'm saying this with all the love in my heart, but what was kind of funny is that after that ritual, maybe like 2 weeks or a month or so later, we actually had pre-planned a ritual writing class for our outer court. And one of the things that we discussed is sometimes less is more. And that when you have a larger group of people, you have to learn how to tailor that back. And, you know, maybe max three pages, four pages, you know, depending on the font size.
Right, exactly. Well, and it's tough because there's so much cool stuff you can put into a ritual.
Oh, yeah.
To just like, nope, this is shiny. I'm putting that in the basket. I'm putting this shiny thing in. And then your basket's overflowing and everybody's there and they're exhausted. Like,
exactly.
That's real. You know, my early rituals were like that. There was entirely too much shit going on.
Oh, and don't get me wrong. The script that he put together was absolutely gorgeous. It was a beautiful and well thought out design, but there was a lot of people there. And unfortunately, I actually had to leave halfway during the ritual because it took a couple hours to get through. Yeah, so less is more, especially depending on the group of people. But okay, so then to piggyback off of my last question, so how do you handle the use of things like tools or symbols or just other ritual components that might have different meanings or significances across different paths?
So there are a couple of ways I handle it personally. So in my home community, when we are going to do a ritual, let's use a harvest ritual as a good example, say for Lunasa, we will bring multiple altars into the space where there are different paths represented, right? So we'll have a heathen altar and a Hellenic altar and a Celtic altar, and we'll have usually a generalized pagan altar that's very sort of earth goddessy. And this way we can have tools that are familiar to everyone. And during the experiential, transcendental part of the ritual, people can go to the altar that works for them. So that's one way to approach it. And the other one is to step back from, you know, athames and blades and cauldrons, and instead focus on primal things like color and natural shapes and light in the darkness, candlelight, you know, and the simple things that come out of witchcraft. So burning a piece of paper that you've written a whole bunch of stuff you want to release on, right? Think about it as coming from a place of powerful simplicity. Sometimes I refer to this as finding the kernel. Like, your kernel in a ritual is like a single word to a three-word phrase that encapsulates the deepest truth of the ritual. And once you know that, you can begin to really build a beautiful container around it. So, you know, for high holidays, we can bring in the folklore and the stories about that point in the year, but we don't get stuck in them in the same way, because we know that these myths serve this kernel, and we then are able to dial things down a little bit. What I'd say is that we just, when you're designing for a cross practice group, you just want to have a little bit more openness. So it either means, you know, that thing where we do an altar for everybody, or we focus on the eternal things that we share.
Beautifully said. Now, let me ask, of course, let me ask now, when, and your years of experience with facilitating these group rituals, do you find, and I'm sure there might be more than one answer to this question, depending especially on the time of year, but do you find that it is easier or best to have one main person who writes the ritual with a little bit of input from others per se, or more of a collaborative process with people in the community? Or because I've run an outer court with my high priest, and him and I have created our own rituals and such for it, and between the two of us writing, we've had some conflict. So yeah. I can only imagine having a much larger group of people, especially people from different backgrounds and traditions. But yeah, what's been your experience? Like, what do you think is the best practice?
So I think some of this depends on your style of practice. So when I was running a coven within the tradition of the Witch's Circle, which is the Wiccan tradition I originally am from, you know, the high priests were the ones who wrote the rituals, which meant basically I wrote all of my coven's rituals with very little input. And I really didn't want a whole lot, because we were following a set pattern from that tradition. What I will say is that writing for a cross-cultural group, collaboration has always ended up for me with a better result. But I also enjoy working in groups. And I think there's a little bit of a trick to it in that usually the way, let me back that up and try it with a full sentence. We have, within Frederick Cups, we have a liturgical team, right? So people, when they are joining the Dragons group, which is the volunteers that sort of make everything happen, they let us know what they really love doing. And some people really love designing and then being a part, one of the speaking roles or one of the people who is doing trance work within a ritual. Like, they really love that. And so we have a liturgical team. So what will happen is I'll get the seed of the idea. Usually we'll get things started and then send that out to the liturgy team, and then we'll just start throwing ideas in, right? So we begin, you know, okay, so we, a good example is we had to take Samhain outside during the pandemic, during that
oh
year
I loved
where, like,
that Samhain ritual outside. Oh, though, oh my gosh, loved
thank
it
you so much. Well, and that was built out of necessity. We, the first year we ran it, we could not be inside the building, right? We were having that second wave, I think it was Omicron or something like that, and we couldn't be inside, not and have everybody be safe. So we did an outdoor version of the ritual. So when the vision that I saw, there's a section of the ritual that we call the Mourning Grove, and we have people write the names of their beloved dead on strips of white fabric and tie them to a tree. And when it's beautiful, right? It's uplit. It's very evocative. You can see them sort of moving in the wind. And what I saw when I was thinking about that ritual was that image. So I sent that out to my team, and then the other altars started being introduced. Like, okay, well, let's approach this as an underworld journey. So somebody was like, we need gates at the beginning and the end. Oh yeah, that's a great idea. Okay. So there's lots of different kinds of ancestors. We should have different places for people to honor these beloved, you know, souls. So, you know, we had ancestors of the blood and ancestors of the order, and we had our animal companions. We had altars for all of these different, and that was the result of a lot of different people contributing, you know, and contributing to the language of it. And you do need one person to be sort of like the asshole with the clipboard and the whistle, who's like riding herd on the process. And that is usually me or Kelly, one of my other really good ritual writers. But the team usually has so many good ideas that a lot of our role as the guide is like narrowing it down. You know, okay, that's wonderful, but that would be the fourth chant, and I think that's maybe too many chants. How about we save that one and use it for another ritual later, right? Like, it's about bringing the vision in and serving kind of what we were talking about, right? The emotion and the kernel, and making sure that everything that we are incorporating still serves this greater vision. And I think there's also just a logistical piece in terms of, you know, I've had people want to bring in body paint and things, and some of it's just like, all right, look, we have to clean up afterwards. So no, I think it would look cool, you're absolutely right, and I refuse to mop the floor that evening, so no, we're not doing that.
Like, only if you bring your own Swiffer. Right, then we'll talk. I will say, I, as an aside, that Samhain ritual was actually one of my favorite rituals I have done. And I actually brought a friend from out of town from New York with me to that ritual. And to this day, he will still bring it up of, remember the time we went to that cups ritual and it was outside? It was fantastic. And I was like, it was really great.
Oh, I'm so glad y'all liked it. I was so happy with how that one turned out. It really... it was such a hard year. And I think for a lot of us, we really needed a good, solid Samhain ritual, you know?
Yeah. And I got to say, with it being outside, even though it was, it actually wasn't terribly cold that night, I remember, but there's something about being outside in the cold during Samhain. Yes. And feeling that, not emptiness, but like that coldness, I think honestly added to the experience. So I did not mind being outside for that, especially with COVID at the time. I really didn't mind.
Right, exactly. But I also completely agree with you. And I think that ties back to this idea of, like, can we connect to the natural cycle? Because as we're moving into Samhain, from at least in my region, of course, this is when the weather starts to get chilly, and we're thinking about the coming winter and the season of darkness and the underworld. And so it adds this other layer of basically ritual theater just by virtue of being its natural self. I'm a big fan of rituals. Some of the ones we've done for Samhain in the past, people will at least pass outside so that they move from one area where they've created a releasing object of some sort, and then they pass through the courtyard where they can then release that object into the fire. And that at least brings them outside into the cold and darkness. And then they go back into, you know, indoors into the large room where we do most of our rituals. But it still allows that moment of like, oh, yes, there's a reason we do this now. This is the ending of the year. The world around us is passing into the image of death. And so this is the time when we honor our ancestors, when we also must wrestle with this concept of death and what it means to us. So yeah, huge fan of stuff outside. But I mean,
absolutely. I hear you. But you know, on this topic of COVID, I'm thinking about when people were having to stay home or stay online. And I had this thought come to me, especially for those who might live in, you know, more rural areas or not have as many people around. Have you ever used technology such as like a Zoom meeting or any other online platform to help facilitate a group ritual?
Yes, definitely. And even that New Year's Day ritual that you spoke about enjoying, we had an online version of that for 2 years while the pandemic raged. Yes. So when you're working with Zoom, we learned some best practices for that as well, right? So we learned that guided meditations are a really good tool then, because that's essentially something you're kind of doing by yourself anyway. So guided meditations are lovely. We did a lot of house style magic. So like our Ostara ritual, we had people charge up a bowl of water with purification sort of energy, and then go through their house sprinkling it. And then they came back to their, you know, their computer or their phone for the wrap up of the ritual. So if you can think about actions that people can do within their own space, that is really helpful. And then one other, I think we could call this more like a piece of sacred theater, is the use of backgrounds and then making all of your speaking people have a consistent background. So for that New Year's Day ritual, you pass through earth, air, fire, water, and spirit. And so all of those guides, which is what we call the priests that serve in those roles, were attired appropriately for the element they were serving, but then the image behind them was sort of like a light design in the right colors, but the design was consistent across guides. So you really have this beautiful feeling of connection. We did another one where we used tarot archetypes, and people over the course of the ritual did a reading slowly that was all about how we're moving into the next year. It was the one we did at Yuletide that year. So that was lovely. And one that we did that was really fun for Yule during one of the pandemic years was we actually took it down a notch and we did storytelling. So we had speakers from different traditions within paganism share one of their winter folk tales, and everybody sat there with like hot cocoa and blankets and candles. And honestly, it was fucking awesome. Like,
oh, that sounds so wholesome.
It
I'm
really
gonna do that.
Was. Like, it was, and especially, like, that was the first year of the pandemic. It was so hard. You know, I think it's easy to forget how it felt then, right? None of us knew if we were ever going to see each other again in person. Like, it was so bad. So sitting around and having our community members tell us stories like Strega Nona, where it was fantastic.
Aww.
And I think maybe that's another piece to bring into the ritual discussion is, what do people need? Like, a lot of times when I'm looking at the next sort of upcoming high holiday, like our Litha ritual is already sort of well underway and designed. But, you know, Lunasa will be coming up next. One of the things when I start considering that one is I'll be like, okay, what does the community need right now? So if your coven or your group or your community has just absolutely been through it, it is totally okay to basically have a snuggle ritual, like the one that I talked about for Yule. You can do ones that are just about connection and healing and warmth and emotional intimacy, and that is also magic. Like, so much of what we do in terms of our own healing has this magical component to it, you know, and just turning the volume up on that ever so slightly is all that it takes to begin this beautiful process of connection.
So speaking of emotional intimacy, I'm going to ask you a question that I know the answer to, but because I've been able to go to some of your rituals, but for those listening, they might not know this. But my question for you is, do you have a post-ritual reflection or debriefing process? And if so, how does that help improve just the mental status of those who have attended your ritual?
Yes, absolutely we do. So we love post-ritual sort of snack and dessert potlucks. And although it may not appear noticeable from the outside, one of the volunteer roles is a position called a liaison. And there are always liaisons for each ritual. And they are people who are not going to be in any sort of ritual looking attire in terms of like having had a speaking role in the ritual. But their role is to look for people who are feeling maybe disconnected or need some help processing. And they're going to find those folks and talk to them. And then for rituals where we know there's a big emotional impact, like the New Year's Day one, we have specific rooms for that. So for the New Year's Day purification ritual, for those of you who are playing along at home, that one basically takes you through releasing all of the bullshit from the last year. It gets a little heavy sometimes. Like that's one of the crying rituals big time, you know. It's so good.
It's so good.
No, it's so good. Like it's so good. And also like everyone does a lot of really heavy work. So we have a verbal processing room for people who like to talk it out. And there is a staff person that hangs out in there. And then we have a quiet room with journaling supplies and coloring pages and usually a couple of snacks and some drinks. Like we put water and cups in everywhere. So just to give people that space to process. I don't love it when like you go through a big ritual and then they're like, okay, get behind the wheel of a car and drive home. When you've like, spent an hour kind of being altered and doing really personal work. Like you need a little time after that.
So we make
a big effort to provide that time to make sure it's available. Another thing that we'll regularly do, especially since there is usually like a potluck or a social hour afterwards, is we will leave our ritual space set up. So the altars will stay lit. There will be guides or altar attendees in the room, and we'll just leave that up for as long as people need it. So let's say there were, you know, like 70 people at a ritual, which is not unusual for our group. And maybe that felt like there were too many. So maybe you wait until everybody leaves to go get snacks. And then you can come up and have a quiet moment at the altar that you would really like to. And so we try to provide that space as well, simply because there are so many different ways people need to process and need to integrate their experience. And then I think one other thing that we've begun doing just recently is we have a low sensory space now. Again, I mentioned this earlier, a lot of us are really neurodiverse. One of the running jokes about Frederick Cups is that like we collectively as an organization have autism, which I think is hilarious because most of us are on the spectrum somewhere. But it means that we're super aware of this stuff. So there is a rocking room at our congregational building. So it's one of those rooms where like there's a window you can see into the sanctuary from, and the sanctuary is where we do all of our rituals. So we've started making that a low sensory space where we put the supplies for the ritual in there. So whatever we're using, you know, whether that's flowers or stones or water. And then we have the door that shuts and people can still see the ritual. They can still hear a lot of what's going on, but they also have this quiet, dark, low sensory space. So if they get overwhelmed, they can be in there. So there's a few different ways we support sort of post-ritual processing and even during ritual processing.
And one thing I want to mention too that I've seen you do, and the New Year's one definitely comes to mind for this, and the Salvin one outside too, but for anybody who's interested in facilitating a group ritual design, especially with a large group of people, perhaps 70, like Irene said, has experience, I really appreciate that you will let people in at a time for some of these rituals, depending on the nature of the ritual, and that it's not just a bunch of people rushing a room. Like, for example, the New Year's ritual, just having a smaller group, because as somebody who has attended that, it lets me feel a little less thinking about the people who are in line and having to rush through it, because when there's only so many people in a room, it just feels a little calmer and relaxed and nice. So that's also one thing to keep in mind, I think, for people listening, is that that is also an option. And as Definitely. Somebody who's done that, I really appreciate that.
Yeah, the rush thing is one thing that I don't enjoy about some large group rituals as well. It's also part of why a lot of our rituals will include some sort of a preparatory space. So just as an example for the Beltane ritual we just did, there are tables where people write on a ribbon a message of love for themselves and then one for the community. And they tie those ribbons to the larger ribbons that are on the maypole. But it means that as people are coming in, they're being invited to pause at this space and think about this blessing that they wish to give the community. And so it slows down the arrivals into the space, and it allows everyone to really fully get present, you know, and we'll space it out so that you don't get to the main sort of location of the ritual until you've gone through a couple things. And it really, there's some conscious design there. And then I'll say one other thing just on an organizational level is after every ritual, the team that designed and offer it, we do a postmortem. Like, we pull up the ritual script, we go through it again, we talk about what worked and what didn't, we add a whole bunch of notes, so that then when we bring it out a couple of years from now, we have already improved it, right? There's this constant level of, can we be more skillful? And I think that one other thing to remember, and maybe this is a good closing thought, is that ritual design and execution is a skill. You know, it's not just it's not an accident. It involves some very conscious choices, some understanding of the dynamics around how people connect, on being able to connect to that emotion, to the visualization, to the story or the narrative of what's happening, to creating the space for people to have that transcendental connection, and to understanding how people enter a space, how they interact within it, and then how they leave. Most of this is, you know, for lack of a better term, practical, right? These are skills. These are pieces of information we can learn and then get better at developing. And I think that that's the other thing to remember. So if you're just getting started designing group rituals, you know, my rituals from 25 years ago are nowhere near my rituals now. I was just learning. I was learning skills. So give yourself grace and time, and don't be afraid to go back and be like, wow, I wish I'd done this way. Write it in. You know, like, leave yourself some notes. You'll come back to that ritual eventually, and then it'll be waiting for you, and it'll be even better than it was the first time.
Oh my gosh, that was so beautifully said. And the type A in me is singing at the idea of debriefing after the ritual to see what improvements or notes we could go through. Oh, I love that.
Oh, hell yeah. Please start postmorteming your rituals. Like, it is such a good practice. Like,
oh gosh,
we can let go of the any criticism is a personal attack piece, which is really hard, right? Like, I get it. A lot of people have that reactivity thing. But like, if you look at it as, this is a skill, this is a, you know, a thing we did that we want to improve, and everybody comes to the table with, ooh, let's add this, or let's adjust that, or I noticed there was a bottleneck at this place. Like, hell yeah. It only improves our skills, you know? And for those of us who want to be in service to community, becoming skillful serves the community. It serves the gods.
Amen to that, or blessed be to that. You're whatever your fancy is. Oh my gosh, Irene, I could talk to you all day about this. I am loving this topic, but I know we do need to wrap up. So let me ask you this. If you could give one piece of advice to beginner, does not have to be related to anything that we talked about today, what would that piece of advice be?
So what I would say is that at this point in time, there's so much good information out there. If it doesn't feel right to you, you can look elsewhere. Just because the witchcraft that you are doing is different than the witchcraft your BFF is doing doesn't make it wrong, and it doesn't make theirs wrong. Like, there are so many flavors of magic and spirituality within this amazing umbrella that is paganism. So Wicca did not work for me. At the time in which I came into this world, Wicca was the only option, right? So I was able over time to find my way into a path that does work. But now, holy shit, try all the candy. Oh my God, if you don't like the candy you have, get other candy, right? Like, you try lots of things. Find the one that feels like home. And you will, you'll know when it's right. It'll scare you and it'll feel perfect at the same time. And that's how you know you're in the right place.
Oh, I love that. There's different ways to solve a problem too. Mm-hmm. Never forget that. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Beautiful. I enjoyed this so much. Irene, how can the listeners find you on the internet?
So I'm easy to find. One of the fun things with having a very old name, like my first name, is that there aren't very many Irenes. So you can find me on social media either as Irene Glass or Glass, that's GLASSE, Witch, WITCH. That's my handle on Instagram. And then I blog weekly at glasswitchcottage.com. Very easy to find. Again, if you Google my name, that's the first thing that will come up. And of course, I present in a lot of different places. So I regularly present at the Sacred Space Conference. I go up north and present with Earth Spirit events. I teach at a lot of different festivals. So if you're somewhere on the East Coast, I will probably be in your neck of the woods at some point in time.
Awesome. And you can find me on Facebook at Seeking Witchcraft Podcast, on Instagram at Seeking Witchcraft, or my personal one, if anybody's interested in that, at Spells and Kettlebells. I am on Patreon at patreon.com/seekingwitchcraft. And yeah, pretty much Google Seeking Witchcraft and you'll find me on the internet. Oh my gosh. Well, Irene, this has been such a pleasure. I cannot wait to go to another cups ritual in the future and see you and see your expertise, because you really do know how to put on a fantastic ritual. And I was so happy to have you come on and talk about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Thank you everybody for listening. Bye.
Bye.
Are you missing the sounds that matter most? What if you could hear every word, every laugh, and every moment crystal clear without spending thousands on expensive hearing aids? Introducing Audionatum, the world's most affordable FDA-approved hearing aid. With the revolutionary A2 chip, you get premium sound, zero background noise, and a 24-hour rechargeable battery. They even have Bluetooth connectivity to connect to your cell phone or TV. Unlike those traditional bulky $5,000 prescription hearing aids, the Audionatum is 90% smaller, 20 times cheaper, and works instantly. No visits to the audiologist needed. Audionatum has over 500,000 happy customers who have trusted Audionatum to restore their hearing. Our 100% money-back guarantee means zero risk to try. Don't like them? Simply return them and get your money back. They also come with a lifetime warranty. For the next 72 hours, the Audionatum is 53% off. Go to tryhearingaid.com right now to order your pair for only $99. Again, go to tryhearingaid.com to order your pair for only $99. Order now before it's too late, as these hearing aids have sold out over 10 times this year. With Audionatum, you can hear life again.